You're listening to Homicide Worldwide. Your host, Sally Inquieto, would like to remind our listeners the episodes deal with crimes that are graphic in nature and may not be suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Hello, Homicide Worldwide listeners. All of us over here at Homicide Worldwide Podcast would like to thank you for coming back each week. We see that you are spreading the word and that our body count is growing. Make sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're kind of on Facebook. If you have an idea for an episode, send us an email to homicideworldwidepodcast@gmail.com. If you want to join our moms in supporting the show, check out our Patreon. Please remember to subscribe wherever you listen and please leave a 5-star review. It really helps out the show. For source material, don't forget to check out the show notes. Forgiveness is such a simple sounding word, but yet such an incredibly complicated and deeply personal action, which hinges largely on one's perspective. Some things, at least to my likely unenlightened thought process, are just so bad that forgiveness is unthinkable. For tonight's case, this is a situation that is so permanently unsalvageable, so unfixable, so incomprehensible, that there is just no coming back from it. I cannot imagine what forgiveness would look like, but I respect anyone who is bigger than themselves, who can find it in their hearts to forgive. In the early morning hours of March 1st, 2008, Terry Caffey lost everything, including his 16-year-old daughter, Erin, but not because she died. Erin Caffey, you see, was in love with 18-year-old Charlie, but the problem was that Charlie was a boy her family did not approve of, for very good reasons. So in Erin's adolescent, underdeveloped mind, she felt that she needed to eliminate the problem that would keep them apart. And naturally that meant to murder her whole entire family. The gruesome details of this case have played out in the public eye for all to see, and for us over here, Erin is totally fair game to judge till the cows come home. She did do these things. She did orchestrate a family annihilation, and it would have been successful if not for the will of her father, Terry, to let authorities know without a doubt who was in the house that night. Not only has Terry survived the most unimaginable circumstances, he's gone on to publicly forgive his daughter, not just for his own attempted murder, but for the killings of his wife and their two younger children. Terry has received his share of judgment in the years after the killings because of this. Admittedly, when I listen to Terry recount his story, it's hard not to wonder, just a little, if his coping mechanism is a way to protect himself from further injury. His disbelief blocks acceptance of reality and allows him to hold on to the only other surviving Caffey family member, Erin. For Terry, Erin could not be behind the worst thing that has ever happened to him. It had to be somebody else who was confusing her. Regardless of which may be true, if it means he has found a measure of peace in an impossible situation that nobody should be faced with, is it really anyone's place to say what is right for him, even if we don't understand it? This is episode 45 of Homicide Worldwide.
Good evening, friend. How are you?
I'm feeling good. How are you feeling?
I'm good. I'm really good. It's so nice to have our producer back in the studio with us. It was the first recording in weeks that we've actually had our theme music played after my intro.
We had to incompetently hum and sing a lot and try to whistle it.
Mm-hmm. That was me and Sally at our best technical abilities. We apologize.
We did. We apologize humbly. It was terrible. It's honestly a wonder that we got it done.
Yeah, no, it totally is.
I had like technophobia, and I knew that you knew all the buttons to press, but I was all at the same time like,
yeah,
he's not here. Something's going to go wrong.
I mean, how many times did I get up in the middle of the episode just to make sure we were really recording?
Just you were like a new mother who was like making sure her baby was breathing.
I don't know what I'm doing.
It's pooping all the time.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we are so glad to be back with you. And I'm Keita.
And I'm Sally.
We are your co-hosts. And this is Homicide Worldwide, our 45th episode.
If this was a wedding anniversary, we'd have gone through the intensive therapy stage, like the almost breaking up stage. The kids graduated. And like, it's just like retirement, smooth sailing, baby.
Exactly. I know. We're going to go buy a boat. And now we're going to go live our best life.
Exactly.
Hopefully not end up murdered.
That is the eventual goal.
So tonight, we're going to be talking about Aaron Caffey, the 16-year-old who is the alleged mastermind, and I use master
and mind
loosely. It's like an oxymoron. I don't know. It just doesn't really work.
She puts the moron in oxymoron.
She really does. You know, this girl who allegedly masterminded having a hit put on her entire family just in the name of selfish puppy love. She thought she was in love when she was 16 with a guy who her parents didn't like. And up until this point, Aaron had really been considered, at least according to her father, Terry, who is the only survivor of this crime, he considered her to be a good kid. Now, when I hear him say that and taking into consideration all the forgiveness that he's offered to his daughter, I'm not so sure that the signs weren't there. I just don't know if maybe he didn't want to see the signs, because he still at this point is really denying her culpability.
Yeah, which is astonishing to me, given the absolute proof that is available, including all of the messages between, you know, her and her boyfriend with his dumbass buddy carried out this horrific slaughter, which it absolutely just was a straight up slaughter.
It absolutely was a straight up slaughter. And so that is our case this evening for Miss Aaron Caffey. Her little friends that she had involved were her boyfriend, Charlie Wilkinson. And he's the one to have allegedly killed her mother. He's also the one who is allegedly the person who attempted to kill Terry, her father. But he does claim that he didn't kill the kids. Moral compass, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to draw the line somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. He claims, though, that he may have stabbed her brother. You know, in my opinion, you either did it or you didn't do it. So you need to pick a lane.
That also gives a little insight into his state of mind. If he says may have stabbed, it was all probably very fast, frenetic, bloody, stabby, flashy. But that seems like a detail that you probably remember.
Yeah. It really does. I mean, I can imagine that it would be kind of a blurry evening, maybe, but I do think that you'd probably remember that part as a child. Then we have Charles Wade, his good pal, Charles Wade. Charles Wade was 20 years old, and he is the one who allegedly killed the kids. Now, when I said that Charlie Wilkinson may have stabbed the youngest child, it wasn't necessarily the stab that killed the child, but he definitely participated in it. Charles Wade is the person that they thought is actually the one who carried out the murders.
Stand-up guy.
Oh, real winner, right? Bobby Johnson, his girlfriend. Oh, Bobby. Could have made some better choices. So Bobby Johnson, she was 18. So, I mean, think of the ages, okay? So it's like three of the four perpetrators were between the ages of 18 and 20.
Oh, God.
Aaron herself, 16. These children threw away their lives. This case, as we get into it, it's just dumbfounding.
Dumbfounding and so clearly evident that they would be the ones behind it.
Right?
I have a lot to say about this later in terms of like the developing teenage brain. I find it very fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And from my adult brain, which is able to, you know, do things like extrapolate into the future and plan and strategize long-term consequences. The fact that that didn't really happen.
No, there was no judgment used whatsoever. And especially with Bobby Johnson, because she had no part in any of the plot as we get into it. She had no part in this whatsoever.
She went in cold.
She was just a quote unquote along for this because these kids had been hanging out earlier and she kind of just demanded apparently to go along.
She just kind of refused to leave. And they're like, all right, well, you're going to not have a great evening, but sure. Oh yes. If you're refusing to like not leave, you are going to be involved in this.
Right. She just sort of inserted herself. I mean, like literally her FOMO really got her into some hot water. So, you know, she really shot herself in the foot because she could have so easily avoided this whole thing and what her eventual sentence was by just either informing somebody about what was going on or just not even going. Don't go along. Don't do it. You can try again in 40 years. You've got you've got 4 decades to think about how you fucked up, Bobby. Choose your path. Choose your adventure, Bobby.
Choose your own adventure, Bobby. Jeez Louise. Yeah. People throwing, you know what? You were right on the money when you said throwing away your life.
Yeah. In terms of the choices that were made that night, the things that were on the table that were presented before them, the options that they had, like number one being like, maybe don't do this. And just the one just stupid, shitty decision after the next that just ended 3 innocent lives.
Horribly too, freaking horribly.
And then also almost killed her father. So, you know, when I say family annihilation, it was supposed to be a family annihilation. And how her dad, you know, whether, I mean, if you think it's the hand of God or if it was just some stroke of luck, that man managed to survive being shot multiple times and escaped a house that was on fire.
And that wasn't the hardest part.
That was definitely not the hardest part.
Jeez.
But here we go. So that's a little overview of tonight's case and the people behind the murders of the Caffey family.
Examples of the prime of American youth. Just complete pieces of shit.
Yeah. This is our future if we're not careful, people.
Yeah. This is almost our present at this point. Holy cannoli.
You know, in the Breakfast Club, when they're talking about it and he's just like, these are the people who are going to take care of us. And he's like, I hope not.
I remember thinking about that at the time when I was watching it and being like, oh, who's going to come after me? And then any time that I talk about the youth of today, and yes, I do talk about the fucking youth of today, but I'm like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But then I think back to I was reading where someone talked about how Socrates said, the youth of today and how they spend all their time carousing in the square. And, you know, I was like, oh, you know what? Thousands of years ago, people were complaining about this. All right. Maybe this is just something that everybody thinks that
now we have them carousing on social media.
See, now that's the one difference though. It's never not been in person before, mm-hmm. You know, carousing at the mall,
Yeah. You
know, carousing at the skate park, but carousing on social media. Can you carouse on social media?
I don't know. I mean, it might not really make sense.
Carousing can only happen in person.
It kind of can, but I'm just saying in general, that's what we're up against. Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of carousing, we're going to take you back to the start of this family and kind of how they came to be.
Yes. So Terry and Penny, they met through church. He wrote this book called Terror by Night, and he describes that his parents were the ones that kind of set this whole thing up. At the time, religion and faith has been a big part of everybody's life in this story. And so at the time, Terry Caffey was kind of looking to find his way with it. But when he reflects back on it, doesn't really think that he really understood what faith was at the time. Mm-hmm. And so he was just kind of bouncing around or whatever. And his parents had said, oh, you know, there's this cute blonde, blah, blah. He was like, oh, cute blonde. Well, okay. You had me at cute blonde.
Everybody likes a cute blonde.
Everybody likes a cute blonde, right? You know? And so he agreed to go to this church function, and that is where he met Penny.
It was a revival meeting.
Yeah, it was something to do in the church. Yes, I think it was a revival meeting.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And like I said, I mean, we're talking about a very small Texas town. You know, it's the Bible Belt and people have a very deep, strong faith.
And it's really it permeates every part of your life.
Yeah. A lot of communities are really faith-based. Mm-hmm. You know, you really have do unto your neighbor mentality. And it's really kind of interesting. I mean, I didn't grow up quite that way. And so to look at a case like this and really get into that, this is truly like their path. This is what they like to do. This is how they want to live their lives. Like, it's kind of cool. It sort of seems like they'd do anything for their neighbors. Like, you sort of wish humanity was kind of like that outside of these small towns.
Right. Seriously. Like, when I think about this sort of barn raising mentality of like, you need something big done, all your buddies come from, all the neighbors come and help you. And like, exactly. This community, people are together. People know if someone's sick, they bring them stuff. They take their kids to school.
There's a trust.
And a wider community that like, you're going to get taken care of. Your community's going to look after you.
Yeah.
We're so fragmented now. Like,
exactly.
We've got so many people who are just like a community of one. It's like, if you get sick, you have to get fucking DoorDash to bring you hot soup because no one the fuck else is going to.
Yeah. I mean, and in communities like this, you know, if Susan gets sick, then Mary's going to bring a pot of soup over and right. It's cool. And it's no big deal. And that's just how it is.
Right. Exactly.
That is how the Caffey family really just lived their lives, to the point where in their driveway after they were married, they had a sign that was Joshua 24:15. If it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose this day whom ye will serve. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Basically just saying that, you know, like that was their mission in life, was to serve God.
I really admire commitment. People who don't just talk the talk, but they really freaking walk the walk.
They sure did.
That is a rare person. And this whole family, well, with one glaring exception, especially guided by Terry's massive, deep bedrock faith. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of pastoring and, you know, was very, very involved in the church, and his children were brought up to be deeply involved in the church.
Yeah. And they had three children. They had Aaron, who is the oldest and 16 at the time of the murders. I just can't wrap my head around it. I'm like, all I wanted to do when I was 16 was get my driver's license. That's all I wanted. I can't imagine that mentality, but I digress. We had Matthew, who is also known as Bubba, and the youngest, Tyler. So Bubba and Tyler were 13 and 8, respectively. Apparently, Bubba wanted to be called Bubba up until like the time of his death. He kind of stopped wanting to be called Bubba.
That was like just right before, like several months or so.
Yeah, it was too little boy or whatever for him. And so he wanted to be, you know, he was growing up. He was 13 and he kind of wanted to be like a person instead of a nickname.
Right, exactly.
I'm going to call him Matthew, just since that's kind of what he had wanted to transition into rather than Bubba. And so from here on out, if I do say Bubba, it's also known as Matthew.
Okay, got it.
Either which way, Matthew, apparently what was said about him is that he, quote, used to witness whoever was listening. So he was deeply into their faith as well. And that when they would go to church, which was several times a week, that Aaron was known to have a really excellent singing voice. Mm-hmm. And apparently she would sing Bible verses or hymns and just songs. And apparently she would be moved to tears because she would get so emotional over the songs that she would sing.
Wow.
And people in their church, like, remember her this way too. So this girl that is described is, I don't know if somehow she had like an alien abduction and was replaced with somebody completely different, because that's not the girl who you would think would be capable of the things that she had carried out. But with that, I also say that because of the faith that was so deeply important in their lives, it was something that her parents were really narrow-minded with certain things because they wanted her to have a specific type of upbringing. And so she was sort of like unable to grow into the person who she might have become if she had just had a little flexibility. I say that because when she was in the eighth grade, Penny and Terry had decided to take them out of the public school system. They had just recently moved to a new town and had been enrolled in public school. There was a girl who apparently had a little crush on Aaron. She made a move and she tried to kiss Aaron, or did kiss Aaron. It was a little unclear, a little like uncertain about if it actually happened. But one way or the other, the attempt was made. And her parents found out about this. The Caffeys found out about this. And they were like, not having it. Not having it whatsoever.
No, I can imagine that going down like a lead balloon. No,
that's exactly how it was.
We would like it to float high like a rainbow balloon. Yeah, just to clarify our own position.
Exactly. And we will clarify that several times throughout the episode. You kind of have to think back to, and hopefully you did listen to the Jeffrey Dahmer episode, if you're listening out there, you have to sort of think back a little bit to the Lionel Dahmer mentality. Mm-hmm. Lionel Dahmer was perfectly willing to forgive Jeffrey Dahmer for killing and dismembering and eating his victims, mm-hmm. but he couldn't deal with the fact that his son was a gay man. And so
that's some deep homophobia right there.
But it's really in line with the mentality of Terry and Penny when he's so willing to forgive her for the fucking ultimate sin that you can commit. He's so willing to forgive that. But when it came to that a girl had kissed Aaron at their school, it was just, no, they couldn't. They just couldn't take that one.
Total deal breaker. Yeah.
And so they pulled their kids out. All three of them got pulled out of school. And so Penny at this point began homeschooling her kids, and she homeschooled them with a Bible curriculum.
There's some social cost to homeschooling.
Yeah.
Homeschooling can go really freaking amazingly well. I've met some homeschool kids that are well adjusted. You know, they have just a different, whole different understanding of the interconnectedness of things because they were allowed to really explore on their own terms.
Yeah.
It can also go very badly.
Yeah.
It tends to go badly socially because you do a lot of practice at school, lot of practice with conflict and awkward experiences and good experiences and how to process your emotions. And there's only so much that that can be replicated in a homeschool environment.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing, like what you were just saying, like these outside experiences, you learn how to be with people who are not part of your family.
That's right.
You know, and when you are homeschooled, you don't have that ability. There are, like you said, there are good things about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can have the one-on-one. Your parents know exactly what you're learning. Everybody's quite literally on the same page with things, but at what cost?
And it does come with a cost. So
I think that definitely it depends on the kid, mm-hmm. for sure, in my opinion. I mean, as no expert on children or anything in the world, I do think that it would really highly depend on the child and the parents. Mm-hmm. Do they have them just homeschooled? And then are they in other extracurricular activities? Like, are they playing soccer? Are they playing baseball or like whatever the case is? Because then maybe there's a little bit more balance. But
that's right.
In Erin Caffey's case, from what I gathered, it was her life was essentially devoted to being isolated at her house, which was about 6 miles from town, completely immersed in their church and 100,000,000% devoted to the teachings of this Miracle Faith church that they were a part of. And certainly, like, if your church and that's where you find a way to be a better person, like, go for it. That was her life. And she was really young.
She was very young. And if you consider, like you said, the isolation, it's not like a suburban situation where you can't see your friends at school, but like, all right, I'm going to ride my bike over to my buddy's house or go across the road and hang out with my neighbor. They're in a cabin with trees all around it. And the nearest neighbor is like not within shouting distance. She's gone from having some social contact now to having almost none.
Right.
It really does seem like, you know, Terry and Penny had this, I'm not going to call it like a habit, but just this mechanism when something went wrong, that they perceived the outside world had kind of, you know, inflicted itself upon their children or had some kind of like a moral attack specifically, or what they perceived to be a moral attack.
Yeah. Like a threat to their moral compass.
Exactly. Specifically, you know, the children's developing moral compass, their instinct was really to withdraw. And the cabin was like, it was a very deliberate withdrawal from the world and pulling the children into, but with that isolation comes a real naivety and an inexperience with consequences and inexperience with people.
Yeah.
You're meant to be developing all those things in your teen years. You're meant to be having enough freedom to not to hang yourself, but like to experience when the rope gets tight, you know, when it's kind of unpleasant. And without that,
well, you have to be able to figure out solutions, right?
That's right.
Life is not a series of easy tasks. It's usually an obstacle course for the majority of us. And so when you don't learn just the basics of how to manage and how to deal with things that come your way when the shit hits the fan, literally, and your whole life is like going down the toilet. Like, you have to be able to be solution oriented and figure it out instead of sheltered. And the way I kind of view her is, my first thought was Sissy Spacek's character in the movie Carrie, or the book by Stephen King.
Oh yeah, I totally see that.
I have read that book cover to cover a million times, but in the movie, for most people, if they haven't read the book, you know, this girl who is so sheltered by her mother, and her mom is deeply religious, and she doesn't want her daughter to have any outward experiences, like to the point where she doesn't even let her go to prom. Like, in my head, that was my first thought, was this might be the way her life was, maybe not to that degree, but similar. Mm-hmm. That just shows the measure of control her parents had exerted over her. And I don't know if that was the case with the boys. I mean, I hate to say this because of the world we live in, but they were boys. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if the parents maybe viewed Erin, because she was a girl, as needing that kind of protection, whereas the boys, maybe they didn't need that protection the same way as Erin might, because they wanted to keep her innocent.
If you're a parent and you look at your child objectively, to the extent that any parent can look at their child objectively, and your child loves attention, she's kind of charismatic, you're like, oh, this is just asking for trouble.
Why couldn't you have been a monster? She's like, I am a monster.
But yeah, no, she was a monster. I think from just that parent red flag perspective, she's kind of checking the boxes of being super cute. She loved attention.
Yeah, she was like the town hottie.
She's a town hottie, and like, more power to her. Like, I kind of wish I'd been the town hottie. I was the town naughty.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. But I, you know what? There's still time to turn that around.
Yeah, well, I was like K-N-O-T. Like, I'm, you know, just naughty.
Yeah, that was mine. That's exactly the spirit that I was, you know, going with that.
With all that being said about Erin, and I have to stress this, so we've made it clear in the past, I'm going to make it clear again, that none of these are our points of view. We are very open to all the different people in the world and embrace it. Takes all kinds. And you know what?
We're a rainbow of humanity.
I just want to live my life. I want you to live your life. It's not our belief, but it does have to do with the story. And so I just have to put that disclaimer in here, because I really do think that what was going on at this time in Erin's life with her parents pulling her out of school really might offer at least a hint, maybe a small clue into why and how, not necessarily to justify at all, because this is not justifiable, but she was kind of just so repressed.
She was.
And she didn't have a way. She was exploding. And so with that, we do have to keep in mind the deep, deep religious beliefs that the Caffeys had. And one of the biggest beliefs was that they did not condone relationships that were not male-female.
It's so interesting to me that Erin was identified by others and self-identifies as a religious person. But how did she reconcile that with committing
murder?
Yeah, straight up the number one thing that you're not meant to do. Like, was there any point where she was like, I'm going to burn in hell for this, which she must have believed at some point that she was going to do?
You would have to think that there would have been that moment where she just had like a lucid thought and was like, bad idea. This is going to, I'm going to burn in hell.
But did she? Because, you know, it seems like, I mean, we'll get to what, when we kind of go through the whole story, but there was, seems like there were so many opportunities.
Yeah, there were.
Throughout this whole thing where it could have been like, yeah, you know what? Maybe I'm just going to put the brakes on this whole murdering my entire family plan.
There were like thousands of opportunities for her not to go forward with this.
Right.
But to go back to the point with Penny and Terry and taking her out of school, just a quick message to our listeners. We will briefly be talking about certain beliefs around sexual orientation. Please know that this is only going to be used as it relates to the case, and in no way does it reflect the beliefs of anyone at Homicide Worldwide. Really debated on putting this in this episode just because it is such an incredibly offensive thing to say, but I'm going to say it because I do think that it has to do with the story. So Terry has said that his family was shocked. This is a quote, shocked by a culture of bisexuality, end quote. And that he blamed the bisexual culture for confusing his daughter, quote, before she finally veered off into the premarital relationship that turned deadly. That's a direct quote from her dad.
Now, Is he talking about a culture of bisexuality at the school or in the wider society?
Unclear on that, but I do believe that he was referencing the kiss from the girl in the hallway,
mm-hmm.
that somehow that qualified in his book as bisexuality. I don't think that at all.
No.
I do think that he was really just incredibly conservative and has an extremely dated way of thinking that has not worn well.
No, it hasn't.
Over the course of time.
Although probably was a reflection of like where he lived and others that he, you know, interacted with.
Oh, 100%.
Like I can imagine that that was like, so funny. Like I always think about what's normal to others, but it's still, again, like we've kind of as a society started to move on. Well, I like to hope we have, maybe we haven't, I don't know. For me, I have this idea of like, I can never judge somebody for things that they cannot change about themselves.
That's right.
And this is the place where my understanding of any place on the sexual orientation spectrum differs from that of other folks, mm-hmm. you know, who may be a more conservative.
Yeah.
My understanding is that this is just wiring and this is kind of how you come out.
Yeah.
And you come out how you come out. And it's not a choice.
No, it's not. And as a parent, I think whenever you choose to have a child, you choose to love that child no matter what.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know, and it's a non-negotiable. So it's like if you have this child, regardless of, you know, how they identify, who they turn out to be, mm-hmm. you love them anyway. And support yeah. them no matter what. But that's just an ideal mindset, I think.
You crazy.
I'm so crazy. I know, I'm so crazy.
All of your unconditional love support for your family and your child. Wow.
I know. At this point, something else had come up. Erin had actually been diagnosed with ADD. She was a little behind her classmates because of it, kind of just not really having her attention focused on school. And so she had started to fall behind a little bit. And this was another reason why the homeschooling was thought like it would make sense.
Yeah.
So that was when she was 13. And so she was homeschooled for quite a while because she didn't go back to public school until she was about 16.
That is a while. And it's like an important couple of years. Those like,
oh yeah.
The early teens, like 13, 14, 15.
Yeah.
When you watch children of that age, you can tell they're doing like some really like intense social wiring.
Yeah.
But they have to be around other children to have that happen.
Exactly. So all of these things coupled with the beliefs of the Caffeys and the homeschooling kind of just made Erin a really shy, sheltered kind of girl. Mm-hmm. And back to your point, Erin's pastor had once made a joke that if he had like five of her, that he'd be able to fill the church on Sundays, you know, and she was cute. And a lot of boys in that church actually said that they would go to church just to see her. Like she kind of brought them in. And again, just going back to the faith base of the community, just by going to see her and them getting into the church, that they became closer to Jesus.
But wasn't it their boners that brought them in?
I think it was their boners that brought them there for sure.
I mean, I don't want to be disrespectful, but
wasn't it?
I think we know it was the boners.
Wasn't it the sins of the flesh?
Truly it was the yes. sins of the balls.
The ball flesh.
The worst part of the body.
Worse than the anus?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So Erin turned 16 in July of 2007. At this point, she got a driver's license, which it's really kind of surprising, that sort of freedom that a driver's license offers. I mean, you get your license and then you get an old Chevy pickup because your dad buys it for you. Now you've got some freedom.
And you've got a little portable shelter.
Yeah.
You've got this little house on wheels now where you can like park on the side of the road.
Yeah. You can just get away. You can get away and just sit and think in your car and like have an alone moment if you need to. She actually started working. Her parents, quote unquote, let her begin working. And she started working at the local Sonic Burger, right? So it's like, again, a very small town. Sonic is sort of like the stepping stone when like a lot of the kids turn 16 and are able to start working. Sonic is sort of like the doorway to the working world. And so she starts working there. I mean, I think the other option was the Dairy Queen.
Mine was the Orange Spot Bakery.
Oh, mine was Giovanni's Pizza. Mm-hmm. That's where I learned to swear. I learned to swear in Spanish at Giovanni's Pizza. Can I speak a lick of Spanish? Otherwise, no.
Can you please just give us a small example?
No, I can't. Okay, so back to Erin. When she got this job at Sonic, one of her coworkers had said that she was, quote, so sheltered that it was like she was seeing the world for the first time.
That's a pretty extreme statement.
especially like when you consider that that was from another teenager. Like, that's some pretty heavy insight.
It is.
Yeah.
And like, you're going to see a lot of stuff at Sonic. I imagine the first like 2 or 3 weeks for her were quite eye-opening indeed.
Oh, 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point too, like Erin was kind of starting to turn, like as most girls and guys to, I'm sure, a degree, you know, we hit a certain point with our age, right? And you get girl crazy or you get boy crazy or whatever kind of crazy is your flavor. And
book crazy.
And so, you know, you kind of want to start like talking to people, like, you know, maybe you want to go out on a date. Maybe you want to make out with a boy at a fellowship meeting and you get caught for it and you're airing Kaffee and your parents are super pissed about this and extremely embarrassed. And you're told you're not going to see that boy no more.
You're not going to see that boy no more.
That's what he told her. That's what her dad told her. And so this was kind of the first guy that Erin, that at least her parents knew about, that Erin had been kind of scamming along with, you know, and they were, you know, whatever, like they were just 16-year-olds. They were making out. And I mean, you know, no parent's going to want to see their kid making out and just macking on some other kid.
But like 16 is not an unusual age to be. It's not like they're seven. 16 is like old enough to like biologically you're old enough to have a child.
Totally. So Terry was not down with it. Like he was basically like, you know, this is my daughter. You're not going to see this boy. It wasn't as though this kid was like the local crack dealer. He was still part of the church community, but it was still not something that they were going to get down with their daughter. You know, I mean, they wanted her to be virginal. And Terry had once said that sex was saved for the quote unquote marital bed.
Snooze.
Hot. So with this, she's just kind of like, what do I do? Whatever. So she kind of ditches this kid and in walks Charlie Wilkinson into her life. Now, Charlie Wilkinson was not the cream of the crop. He was definitely like where this other boy that she was making out with was, you know, not ideal in her parents' eyes. Charlie Wilkinson was like the antithesis of what they would want for her. And so they met because he cruised into Sonic one day and they started talking and they kind of built a little relationship together. And so when that happened, you know, she came home and she told her dad, she was just like, oh, I met this boy. And when they first met him, Terry had been at work and he came home. Charlie Wilkinson was at the house sitting in Terry's recliner chair.
Hell no, you don't sit in dad's fucking recliner. Get your fucking little ass out of my fucking chair, you little bitch.
Not only was he in the recliner, but he had his legs kind of like over the arm of the chair. Like,
oh, no.
In a really disrespectful kind of a way. Like, this is my house, bitch.
That's not cool.
And so when Terry walked in through the door, this is how he found Charlie Wilkinson sitting in his chair. And this is like, you have to remember, this is his first impression of this kid.
Now you can salvage it. You've got about 2 seconds to salvage it. You scramble to your feet. You tuck in your shirt and you apologize sincerely, sir, for sitting on your chair like that. That was very disrespectful. Sir, my name is Charlie Wilkinson and it's a very great pleasure to meet you. And I do apologize again. You extend your hand and give a firm, dry handshake. Maybe he'll let it pass.
Well, that didn't happen. Charlie's reaction was when Terry walked in the door, he said, oh, you must be Charlie. Charlie continued to sit in that recliner with his leg kind of flopped over, looks up at Terry in Terry's house and says, yeah, and you are? Could you die?
Can you imagine?
Could you die?
Oh, I would be like, well, I wouldn't be the one dying. Let's put it that fucking way.
No.
Holy sh.
No. Doesn't Texas have like gun laws? Like, can't you shoot people in your house?
Can't you shoot people who are rude to you in your own home?
I think in Texas you can.
You can.
You can shoot them for being rude. And I'd get behind it.
Or being not rude in Texas.
Exactly. You're just in my house. I shot you. And so that was the basis for his relationship with Charlie Wilkinson.
Shitty first impression.
Yeah, dude. And it never got better.
Because like it was based in complete reality about who this person was. You know, was it Oprah who said when somebody shows you who they are, believe them the first time.
Oh, that's brilliant advice.
But it's true. Like when someone shows you who they are, if someone shows you they're a little punk who sits in your chair with his leg insouciantly lounging with his fucking dirty ass cowboy fucking boots. I'm sorry, but like you don't get to wear cowboy boots unless you've actually like had a little bit of life experience.
Yeah, exactly.
Which he's about to get.
He's about to get like a whole life sentence of experience.
A whole life sentence of experience.
Well, Charlie had kind of gone and he'd apparently gone into a boot camp. He was planning to go into the National Guard. When he met Aaron, he said that there was an instant vibe between the two of them. And they started dating around Halloween is when he asked her out. Apparently, like all of his friends were like, he is completely in love with her. He's totally fascinated with her. He's like infatuated with her. And he talked about her 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Oh, my God. I read a little about teenage brain chemistry. And like when you're talking, I'm just like, oh, serotonin, dopamine. Oh, you know, I'm like seeing it from this whole new perspective.
Yeah. So either way, he was completely infatuated with Aaron and his nonchalant attitude toward Terry being just, you know, and you are. I mean, honestly, if this kid had been in my house and that had been my situation, I'd been like, you better get the fuck out of my house right now and do not come back ever.
Game over. That's just straight up. I honestly don't know why it wasn't game over right. I guess if the kid's 18.
Well, the kid's 18, but his daughter was only 16. And so this is really where I have a little bit of a disconnect with events as they happened. If they were so overprotective of their daughter, kissing this boy who was part of their congregation in the church, who they knew, whose family they knew, I don't completely understand the math behind allowing this relationship to continue with Charlie.
Mm-hmm. Where do you perceive that it's going to go from here?
Well, right. I mean, if this is your impression and you know that he's clearly a little punk, he's a little asshole, and he's going to be disrespectful to you in your house. Like, what do you think is, you know, I'm not trying to victim blame here, but like, what do you see as the path? Like, I'm curious to know, like, why you wouldn't put an end to this.
I actually have a theory on that.
Tell me.
And my theory is that if they thought that it was going to happen anyway, regardless of whether or not they gave their permission.
Yeah.
I think that they thought, if we sort of say that we're going along with it, at least we'll have some oversight.
Yeah.
It won't happen away from us. It won't happen secretly. We'll know what's going on. We'll see how often he sees her. And boy, did he see her.
Yeah.
Holy crap. It was like on her fucking half hour break.
Yeah.
He's right there.
Yeah. He's at Sonic, just
like at Sonic waiting for her, like a puppy at the door.
Yeah. Just scratching at the door.
Let me the fuck in.
Yeah, exactly.
God, fuck. Ew. And like at night when she's finished, there he is. He turns up at their house all the time.
Yeah.
Damn. He was just like up her skirt.
Yeah.
I mean, not literally as far as I know. Who knows?
Well, no, it did eventually happen.
Well, it did eventually happen. Yes.
Well, the other thing too is like he took it to like the next level. So yeah, like you said, he was at the house all the time. Mm-hmm. He had to leave by 9. That was their curfew. He had a car so he could get himself to and fro. But he would get home and then they would talk on the phone until whatever her phone curfew was up, which was like 10 on the weeknights and 11 on the weekends. And then he like really next leveled himself when he started going to church at their church.
That is next leveling.
It really is.
And imagine being Terry and Penny and that dude walks in and you're like, oh, what?
Right. When you're like, good heavens.
Golly gee, with willikers, shaking fist.
Exactly. So the pastor at Miracle Faith Church said, quote, what I knew of Charlie is he seemed like a nice boy. I don't think anyone worried about him and Aaron at first. We thought it was puppy love.
You got to be careful with the puppy love. It turns into Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
And you remember what happened there? Everybody died.
Well, but the other thing too, and it is like layered and complicated, is I really think that because it's a small town built on faith, built on trust, they probably think that those types of problems are reserved for like, you know, city folk and, you know, people who are heathens, not people who are church going good people. Right. You know, so.
But this is just going to work itself out.
Exactly.
Like, it's going to fall apart. You know, it's going to run its course. You know, if we try to stop them, it's just going to get stronger. Let's just let it run its course and let it burn itself out. And they're just going to want to go their separate ways. They'll break up. She'll like cry in her room for like a week. We'll be done. I can imagine absolutely a perfectly reasonable conversation like that.
Yeah, absolutely. But the biggest red flag to me anyway is Charlie Wilkinson was still in high school. Okay, he was a senior, but Erin, like I said before, she's been homeschooled up until this point, has been allowed to get this job at Sonic, starts dating him in Halloween around Christmas time, wants to go back to public school. And why?
I wonder why.
Why? Why?
Why could that possibly be?
Because Charlie's there. Hello. And so, you know, I mean, they were inseparable. Absolutely inseparable.
Love amongst the lockers.
Oh, yeah. Well, also, too, I guess that her younger brothers had asked if they could go back to school. They had missed their friends, and so they were allowed. And so her mom and her dad worked out like, OK, well, if the boys are back in school, like, you know, we've kind of done what we can do and with the homeschooling. And I think, you know, Penny was probably, you know, wanting to make a little money of her own. And so they said, OK, you know what? This makes sense. But you know, really her MO was that she wanted to be with this boy. And so they just really, while they were in school, like, you know, they were just in her truck or, you know, off on their own and this and that. And so, you know, they just kind of morphed into this really unhealthy, extremely torrid relationship, it sounds like.
So I did a little bit of research about the teenage brain. And what happens is there's two important things that are developing. And the one that happens first, the one that sort of comes online first, is not the smart one. So when you start going through puberty, your hormones target the amygdala. The amygdala is this little dude in your brain. It's like fucking gland or some shit in your brain. It's a little something in your brain. It's a thing in your brain. So these teenage years are really important from that brain development standpoint, specifically because there are two sort of brain systems that are forming. The limbic system, which is primarily very emotional and is largely controlled by the amygdala in the brain. And the prefrontal cortex, which is our sort of adult brain, which has the executive functions of planning and self-regulation and time management and all the important decision makings and tax paying. And it's responsible for all these different things. But the amygdala and the limbic system, they kind of turn on first and they are highly emotional. Add to this, the limbic system is very involved in the rewards feedback system. And it's hooked into dopamine so that when something pleasant happens and you receive the dopamine hit of like the reward for your behavior that your brain gives you, that feeling of reward is very, very, very heightened in teenagers compared to adults. So they experience dopamine-based rewards when they have pleasure or when they have new love. That fucks with your brain anyway. Like, that is some serious chemistry that happens when you are in love, especially for the first time. And when this all hooks into the changes that happen, then you get a lot of unpredictable outcomes. But at the same time, you know, don't murder your whole family.
Yeah, exactly. And get your limbic system under control.
But it does explain, I mean, it doesn't excuse this behavior.
No.
But it does help to explain some of the extremes of how we got here, of just like, it was kind of like a perfect storm of dumbassery, malice, stupidity, and then just like a profound amount of teenage hormones. And for Erin, teenage hormones that had been restrained, repressed, denied.
Absolutely.
And then suddenly it was just like, I mean, we are all systems go at this point. I can imagine that was intense.
Right. And she met this boy who really tapped that within her. Mm-hmm. Like, there was something about that relationship.
Possibly quite literally.
I think he did tap that.
Yeah, I think he did tap it.
But quite literally, he was the kind of like this catalyst for her. Like, he opened her up and they did spend time outside. Oh God.
You can. I mean,
I'm sorry.
And he touched way down deep inside her. He reached.
And then he entered her.
He entered the deepest part of her. Oh, we have to stop. This is awful. It's terrible.
Horrible.
Awful, terrible. Funny though.
But at this point, all of what we were talking about before, and they were not allowed to kind of go out by themselves. Terry is starting to now allow them to go out to dinner every now and then by themselves. And so even though he doesn't like this kid, even though they're hoping that this relationship fizzles out, even though they're kind of banking on that, he's allowing just a little bit more flexibility within this relationship, a little bit more flexibility with the parents who already hate this kid and who don't approve of him at all. Because at this point, there are certain changes that they're starting to see within Erin. Like she's starting to throw an attitude at her mom, you know, and she's starting to be disrespectful. She's starting to be rude, more so toward her mother than her father. And so at this point, unbeknownst to the Caffeys, Charlie presents Erin with his grandmother's engagement ring.
Boy.
As a promise ring, not a real engagement. Like, don't get your shit twisted up, Erin. This isn't a formal proposal.
But dude, it's not like a fucking ring from like Claire's.
We're not talking about like a cigar band.
No.
This is a legitimate engagement ring that belonged to his grandmother. It was a family heirloom. And so.
Yeah. No pressure though. Sure.
Right. Uh-huh. No.
Mm-mm. No pressure. Wink.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, and again, he's now 18, right? And so she's 16. And so isn't that like, what do we call that? Statutory rape? He's technically an adult. She's still a child. So now he's presenting this child with an engagement ring, calling it a promise ring.
That's your hymen is mine ring.
Yeah, exactly. I will take your hymen. At this point, Penny notices it like a day later. And she's like, what the heck is that? And Erin was like, oh, he gave me this ring and it's a promise ring and the blah, blah. And so at this point, Terry finds out about it and he's just like off the hook pissed. And so he goes and he finds Charlie at this church function that they're at. Charlie's out there, you know, he's like playing some basketball and hanging out. And so Terry says, hey, I need to talk to you. This is totally inappropriate. You gave my daughter this ring. What do you mean you're promising yourself to her? Like she's 16. Like, what the fuck are you doing? And so Charlie apparently at this point, and this is really where if I had been a parent and this was a situation, I probably would have just kicked him right in the balls.
Oh.
This one. Charlie looks at Terry, shrugs, like, eh, whatever. And then goes back and starts shooting some hoops. Ooh.
Ooh, you are cruising for a bruising at that point, buddy. That is some little punk behavior right there.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh, gross.
But what's even more so is at this point, Terry says, okay, you guys can only be together once a week in our home under our watch. We are going to supervise this. Like, no more dinner dates. You know, I mean, they still have the option to see each other in school. But outside of that, it was only limited to once a week. And so, of course, you can imagine, you know, the limbic system is not happy about this at all. And so, you know, she's having a fit.
The reproductive system is super, super duper unhappy about the whole situation.
Yeah, it's just overriding every good judgment that she could possibly make. And so Erin's super pissed about this. And then she goes and she tells her aunt that she's going to run away when she's 17 and be with Charlie. Why didn't you just do that, Erin? That was like plan A. Way better plan. I'll tell you what would have exactly what would have happened. 1 month, she'd be back. Easily. Why? Because where are they going to live? Charlie doesn't have a job. He's got a 91 Explorer that's got to get push started.
You know who's going to be push starting that, bitch? You!
Erin is going to be push starting it when she's like 9 months pregnant. That's the kind of life you're signing up for, Erin.
9 months pregnant.
With a guy like this.
And then you'll have to run after it and jump in while you're 9 months pregnant. One hand reaching for the handle, one hand yeah. holding the baby in.
Exactly. While you're giving birth and in labor, that's going to be your life. So that was her original plan, was that she was going to run away when she turned 17, which really was not that far away. Like, we're kind of at the beginning of 2008 at this point. And, you know, the murders happened in March, right? So we're still in the very beginning of 2008. She was going to be 17 in July. You had 4 months. Four. That's all you got to do. 16 weeks, Erin.
Long-term planning.
God.
Executive functions all in the prefrontal cortex. Still not developed.
Still not online. I got it.
Nope. And it's just so stupid. Like, again, from the adult point of view, this is just such an unforced error.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Well, at this point, Erin had kind of mentioned to Charlie that apparently at one point, Penny slapped her in the heat of an argument. And I was like, right on, girl.
Sometimes you have to make your point.
I hope to God that that was an open palm slap. Like nice, like five, like four fingers and a thumb.
I don't usually advocate for violence against children.
I don't know.
But if the child is a like mass murderer,
Yeah,
I usually waive that rule.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little like, you know, loophole.
It's a loophole.
And then in February of 2008, right? So this is a month before the murders. After all of these restrictions have been implemented, Penny overhears Erin talking to Charlie on her phone past curfew. She's just like, had enough. She's like, you're fucking grounded. Give me your car keys. Taking your phone.
Ooh, lockdown.
All the visits that he would normally have, the now once a week visits, have been completely suspended. In addition to this, because they took her car, Penny or Terry, probably Penny, was taking her to and from school every day.
So she really knows where the hell she is pretty much all the time. I mean, school is like, a lot can happen at school, but for the most part, she knows exactly where she is and exactly who she's talking to.
On the heels of this punishment, as she perceived it, I think even though I don't agree necessarily with their conservative viewpoints on certain things, I definitely think that her parents were on the right track with trying to gain some separation between these two. They were clearly not good for each other. And her parents obviously saw this, albeit too late, but it was in early February when all of this happened that she introduced the fucking idea of murdering her parents to Charlie. They had talked about this for like a month.
It wasn't a heat of the moment thing.
No.
And I mean, this is where I'm just like, okay, adolescents aren't great at long-term planning, but this kind of seems
sociopathic, psychopathic.
Doesn't it? Psychopathic, narcissistic, just like,
just it checks so many boxes. So now that she's brought this subject of murder up to Charlie.
As you do.
You know, like, I wonder what that would have been like. The very first introduction, like, oh, I just could kill them. Or I want you to kill my parents. Like, what? Which is it? Like, you know, was it like,
they're like in the McDonald's drive through.
She's like, God, I just wish they were dead. You know, like,
We could just make that happen.
Yeah. You know what we should do?
I know. How do you broach it? Fuck.
Yeah.
That is a big question. I would love to have been a fly on the wall.
Right. Like, what do you do? Like, you know what we should do? Like, we should totally kill my parents. Don't worry. It's coming.
Hello, listeners. All of us here at Homicide Worldwide are very excited to share one of our favorite podcasts with you. It's called Nerded Through the Grapevine, and here to tell you more about it are four best friends.
Hey, everybody. I'm Dane Holland.
It's a new STD, a sonic transmitted disease.
I'm Austin Shazam Pfeiffer.
So it would be just a smushed mashed potato situation going on in my young adolescent crotch area.
I'm Marcus Whitaker, known as I'm Electric Man.
So instead of talking about how CERN is trying to open up a portal to hell and end the entire universe, I guess I'm just going to read jokes off the freaking internet.
And I'm Austin Tiny Zen. Dr. Strange, he's circumcised because would you want an uncircumcised wizard? I don't think so.
And if you'd like any of that to make any sense whatsoever, tune in to Nerd It Through the Grapevine, a podcast where four best friends gather weekly to talk about our favorite parts of past, present, and future nerd culture every Monday on Spotify, iTunes, and whatever your favorite app for podcast is. Come join us in the grapevine.
You can find Nerdy Through the Grapevine wherever you listen to podcasts.
So because Charlie wanted to be with Erin, he was like down to do what, like whatever was going to make her happy or whatever was going to get him the nookie.
Yeah.
And so I think it was probably more the latter.
Mm-hmm.
People in school who remember the relationship really remember her kind of just having him wrapped around her finger.
Yeah.
Like he was just whipped and they weren't really like intimate until kind of close to the murders.
He was in it to win it.
He was kind of like, I'm going to do whatever it takes.
I mean, underpantsly speaking.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, it wasn't like she was putting out and, you know, he was just doing this because she was a great lay. Like, it didn't sound to me like they had any real intimacy until like toward when the murders happened. So Charlie, being the genius that he was slash is, apparently had told several of his pals that there was a plan in the works to murder Aaron's parents.
Why can't people keep their mouths shut anymore? Is it like a social media thing?
I mean,
that you just have to share?
But it was 2008. It wasn't like now.
It's true. It's like, I feel like that share button and the good feeling that you get from it is why people just can't keep their mouths shut. But like, you're right. 2008 was like,
He was still out of MySpace. I mean, which I'm going to get to in a second.
MySpace.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, what were we just talking about a second ago? It's like long-term planning. You know, he's not thinking, you know, he's probably thinking that this might make him sound like a little bit of a badass when he's a little bit of a bitch. And so apparently during this conversation with his friend that, you know, going into detail about that there was this potential idea to murder her parents, he said, quote, I wish I could just get her pregnant so the Caffeys would have no choice but to accept me, quote.
What a prince among men.
I mean, pal, you really think that knocking up their 16-year-old daughter is going to gain acceptance? You might be inserting yourself into their lives in a permanent way if you choose to stick around because you don't seem like that kind of guy. But I mean, at the end of the day, how are they going to accept you? If they don't accept you now, they're not going to accept you getting their daughter pregnant out of wedlock when they're this strict and this religious. They're not gonna be down with that. They're never gonna like you.
Also, just like that's a real bad reason to have a kid. To trap like future wife's family into accepting me. That child's not gonna be screwed up at all.
No. While she's pushed starting my 91 Explorer.
Jesus, that's true.
I mean, don't get me wrong, Explorers are great cars.
They really are.
But here's the kicker. Here's the best part about that is evidently at some point, like he must have brought this up to Aaron about getting her pregnant so that they would accept them. She said to him, I'm too young to have a baby. You're too young to have a baby, but you're not too young to put a hit on your family. Interesting logic, Aaron. And so after all of this, it was really noticeable by some of the church congregation, some of the members, including the pastor's wife, that Penny seemed really withdrawn for most of February. Apparently there was like a women's church retreat. She was supposed to be a part of it, and she didn't go because she felt that she needed to spend more time with her family, which I can understand. Like, you know, here's your daughter. She's, you know, clearly not headed down a great path with this boy. Yeah, I would want to be present, too, if I was in that position. And so
things are turbulent.
Yeah. And, you know, you want to support your husband and make sure you're there. And interestingly enough, with the murders, the timing was just unbelievable because Terry Caffey's dad had passed away like a week to the day before the murders happened.
Oh, no.
And when they had his funeral, you know, I had said earlier in the episode that Aaron was quite the little singer in the church. And apparently her go-to song was Amazing Grace. Probably not the easiest song choice. You know, I mean, if you think about American Idol, it's all about song choice.
It's got a lot of range.
Yeah, exactly. And so apparently she used to be able to belt this out like no problem. But somebody, one of her family members had said that she couldn't sing a lick.
The spirit had left her.
Exactly. Like Charlie Wilkinson had extracted the spirit of Aaron
by just sucking it out of her with his just being an assholeness.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It was really, really noticeable. Like this wasn't just something that was like a mild, like familial drama where you could just, you know, grin and bear it. This was like people noticing that something was really, really wrong. And so at this point, Aaron had kind of just, people said that she fell under Charlie Wilkinson's spell. And I have a really hard time with that sentence because I don't think she fell under Charlie Wilkinson's spell. I think that they were a really toxic combination of personalities, of agendas, of just thought processes. But I don't think that Aaron, she's too calculating to fall under somebody's spell.
I agree. And, you know, we've seen this before. Like, sometimes you just get a really bad combination of people. Like Fred and Rosemary West.
Exactly.
A perfect fucking storm.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's how these two were as well. They were just like hormonally.
Yeah.
In terms of their, I mean, he said they had an instant connection. And I believe that's true. Like, I don't think he's blowing smoke.
Yeah.
You know, many of us who have experienced that, where you do have a connection with someone, it might be even as a friend, it might not even be a romantic connection or, a lusty connection, but you have that like sizzling feeling when you're like, oh, we really get each other.
Yeah, exactly. And whatever that looked like within their relationship, they really couldn't separate them outside of the home.
Codependent.
Yeah. I don't know. The word that I keep going back to is just they were toxic with each other. And so the church people were like very aware about how the Caffeys felt. They said the parents didn't like the boy. They were trying to break them up. They told people at church that they didn't have a use for him. He was also older than Aaron and liked to drink, which didn't fit with the Caffeys' lifestyle or beliefs. And that makes sense because February 27th, Penny's sister had told her, you might want to go check out Charlie Wilkinson's MySpace page. The reason that her sister knew about this MySpace page is because Aaron had been at her house and she used the family computer, and Penny's sister was able to see the history and she was able to see what Aaron visited. And one of the pages was Charlie Wilkinson. And it showed, it was just all about sex and drinking and all the things that the Caffeys were not going to have for their daughter. And so Penny, under advisement, goes to the local library because they did not have a family computer in the house. And she checks out the MySpace page and then sees all of this shit. And she's just like, oh my God, this is who our daughter is involved with. And so she tells Terry. They have a literal come to Jesus moment. And when Aaron gets home, they say, we need to talk to you. And she's like, what the fuck? Just like that.
What the fuck?
And Terry says to her, it's over. You're breaking up with him today, like right now. And at this point, Aaron completely blindsides them with her reaction, where she says that she's been wanting to break up with Charlie for a while and just didn't know how to do it.
Oh, this is all going according to my plan.
And it's completely disarming, right, to the parents, because they want to trust her. They want to believe that their little girl is this innocent girl who just got caught up with this bad boy and he's, putting a spell on her somehow. And so
Dickmatized.
Dickmatized, exactly. And so at this point, they're kind of like, oh, okay. Well, you just tell them that we're forcing this and it's all going to be okay. This is February 27th.
And how long is that before the murder?
Several days. March 1st is when the murders happen.
Oh, like 3 days.
Yeah. My first thought with that was the most calculating and manipulative action that she could possibly have was to not skip a beat and tell her parents in that moment that she'd been wanting to break up with him. What better news could they have hoped for? Right. And so they're like, oh, fuck yeah. Okay. We got our baby back. Right. Well, in the background, operating, with this plan was that douchebag Charles Wade that we were talking about in the very beginning. He was older, right? He was 20, but prior to that had been kind of considered a good student, not really a troublemaker, just sort of like there, he's just there. And so he just kind of like did whatever, but he's friends with Charlie Wilkinson. And he's also in the midst of a custody battle with his soon-to-be ex-wife of their 5-month-old daughter.
That's so young to be saying those things,
It is, right? Isn't it, though? It's also really young to plot a murder against your parents when you're 16. So these people were really wildly ahead of themselves.
They really were prodigious.
So because Charles Wade did not have the funds to deal with the custody situation. It sounded like the divorce is pretty ugly. I don't know what they could be fighting over since he didn't have any money. I guess custody, but
yeah,
that's about it. But he didn't have money for legal fees, right? And so he was kind of hard up. And unfortunately for him, he was not the brightest bulb on the tree and he was really down to do whatever it took to get the money. Aaron wanted her family dead. There was a little bit of a payday involved. It was about $2,000. And so Charles Wade.
Wow, human lives go cheap these days. Damn.
Right? I know.
that's not a lot of money. Damn.
It's not. Not even in 2008. No. It's not a lot of money. And, you know, he's down to clown. So he fucking just followed along with this 16-year-old girl's plan and his buddy who's 18. And really, they thought they had the fucking whole thing figured out. So they, along with Charles Wade's new girlfriend, Bobby Johnson. Mind you, he's still married, not quite divorced yet. Now he's on to Bobby Johnson, who I just, God, this girl. She had so much going for her, apparently, until she met Charles Wade.
Yes, she did.
People had described her as being really bright, really bubbly. She was a good student. She was involved in theater. She was described as, quote, bright, intelligent, and articulate.
Does it not seem odd to you that both of these girls were going well in their lives until each of them met, wait, a boy named Charles W,
I've
who
never
was
thought
2 years older than them.
Oh, God, what a horrible parallel.
I know, right? There's a lot going on there. It's a little X-Filesy.
Oh, Jesus.
The circle is now complete.
It's something in the name.
I know. You're going to say it and while you're looking in the middle. Charles, Charles, Charles.
No, don't say it a third time.
I just love tempting fate.
In addition to being described as bright, intelligent, and articulate, Bobby was also said to have, quote, a very strong sense of right and wrong and a very strong moral value system. That was how somebody described her.
Not strong enough.
I mean, Bobby, girl.
Bobby, you had, oh God, you know, sometimes you just have to say no. It is the hardest thing in the world when peer pressure is right up your ass, especially in a situation like this where it's like, it's peer pressure to do something pretty serious. So it's not like, I don't want to go that, or I don't want to like toilet paper the teacher's lawn.
I don't want to smoke weed with you.
Right, exactly. This is like the stakes are super high here. So like, it's there's never a better time
to say no than now?
Yeah, this is the time to use your integrity, girl.
This is the time to say no. I mean, just say no.
All right, but she didn't. Bummer for her.
Yeah, well, you know, she made a really fucking stupid choice. When she met Charles Wade, I said that she was, you know, a good student and all that. She started ditching school. Mm. She was bailing on her friends. She was kind of cutting out from work. She worked at the DQ, the Dairy Queen.
Stigmatized.
He's so gross. I cannot imagine.
I know. It's really unfortunate.
That?
Yeah, it's the matized part. It's that like,
I just imagine him smelling like at least 4-day-old scalp oil.
Oh, that's like that and feet for me. Deal breaker. Across the board, deal breaker. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Nope. No. Yeah. Nope. I'd rather it be BO.
Oh. Oh, no. Uh-uh. None of it.
Yeah, but like scalp oil. No, it's feet, scalp oil, BO. That's the order.
Okay, so after they get together, Bobby Johnson, you know, I said MySpace, right? MySpace apparently was just really rampant amongst these kids. And so she had one and it stated, her page, I love Charles Allen Wade.
Charles Allen Wade sounds like a total like sniper name.
Kind of does. And then I also like to have fun and hang with my friends. Pretty much most of the time, I'm a happy person who likes to make people laugh or just laugh, period. Oh, and I love guys.
Mm. Like Hemingway.
What a poet.
Really, it's the new American novel.
So that's kind of Bobby Johnson in a nutshell. She was just sort of this girl who was there. Like she really wasn't like, she wasn't great friends with Aaron. Like they had become friends because of the guys, you know, as you do, like when you meet a couple and, you know, you sort of just become friends with the group or whatever.
You're kind of like obliged to be friendly with them. And it's better to be friendly with them if you're going to be hanging out together all the time than not to be.
Yeah. Well, and as a couple, it sometimes is really hard to find other couples to hang out with. You know, you're like, oh, he's cool. She sucks. Or she's cool. He sucks.
Yeah.
You know. It's never been me. I've never sucked, for the record. So this brings us kind of up to the night of the murders. We've gotten into who all of the players are for the most part. At this point, technically, it's February 28th going into March 1st. Terry had a pretty strenuous job where he worked really like long hours. He was on call this particular weekend, and I think it had been something like a 14-hour day for him. So he got home really late. He got home around 9:30. And Penny, as she did as a dutiful wife, as I would do for my husband, I would have dinner, you know, You had a long ass day.
That's just supporting your partner.
Just, it's just a nice thing
to
do.
That's nothing to. Yeah, exactly. I don't care if you're the wife or the husband.
Yeah, exactly. She, you know, saw that he was tired. She went and she popped the whatever was the dinner. I think it was spaghetti. Pops it in the microwave.
Yeah.
And is like, you know, they chat for a little while. She's tired. She's had a long day too. And she's just like, you know, I'm going to go to bed. I'll see you in a little while. And he's like, yeah, okay, I'll be right behind you. I'm pretty tired. And so at this point, I bring all of this up because it really leads into a really important aspect of this evening. When Terry was finished with that particular dinner, it was like too much on his plate. And he was like, fuck, it's late. I'm going to just, you know, scrape it off. Well, he misses the trash can and then slips in the spaghetti. It's like, it doesn't get better, right? It's just like a series of really shitty events.
That sounds like a fucking Tuesday night to me, baby.
I mean, really, you know how I live my life. It's definitely on the edge. And so he slips in it, right? And the boys are in the living room. They're watching a movie. Erin is also in the living room and she's watching a movie because she's now broken up with Charlie and her parents are feeling really optimistic because now they, in their mind, think it's over with him. And he is, you know, no longer a part of the lives of the Caffey family. And they're like, you know, finally moving towards some semblance of normalcy within their family, right? And so Erin hanging out with her brothers was a great sight for them to see. And the kids, when they see him slip in the spaghetti, start laughing, as you do when your parent falls down in front of you. You just laugh and point. And so, I mean, I know I do to my mom. I'm like, oh my God, look at you on the ground.
Yeah. I mean, what else are you supposed to do? Help them? God. And then you film it.
And so it was all in good fun, you know, and whatever. And it was like, he laughed at himself. He's like, how stupid. And so somehow, some way, a pillow fight ensues. And I say that to say we're leading up just hours away from the murders. Erin is involved in watching movies and hanging out with her two little brothers and gets into a fucking pillow fight with her dad.
That's so like,
no, knowing full well that in like 5 to 6 hours, they're going to fucking violently die.
Like, what was the mindset? Was she aware of it? Was she just kind of like in the moment?
No, she was aware.
Just, I mean, was she like, had she, but of course she was aware it was going to happen, but was she like aware in that moment or had she put it to the back of her mind and was she pretending? Was she gleeful? Was she like, haha, these people are going to be dead soon? Like, I would kill to know what her mindset was. Was she like, oh, I'm going to lose them soon. So I'm going to spend the last time, you know, having fun with them. I doubt it was that one. I would love to know.
Yeah. Like, why would that even be her mentality anyway?
She doesn't have that depth. Or was it just straight up play acting? I mean, my guess is from what we know of her. Yes.
Yeah. I think it was straight up play acting. The way that she manipulated her parents into thinking that she was happy that she was going to break up with Charlie Wilkinson. Same exact thing. I can't see any other thing that makes sense with this. So at around 3 a.m., you know, the Caffeys have cleaned up the spaghetti mess. They've all kind of put their whatever away. He's gotten into bed with his wife. They're hanging out. They're talking for a little bit. They go to sleep. Just like any other normal night. Kiss goodnight. I love you. I love you too. See you in the morning. Around 3 a.m., everything goes to hell in a handbasket. So March 1st, 3 a.m., Terry, because he is the only survivor of this attack, we have a really unique insight that we don't normally have with a lot of these cases in that he's able to describe the way everything goes down. So we have like a firsthand account of how these events happened.
With pretty remarkable clarity.
Extremely remarkable.
Probably from his end, a little fucking too clear.
Yeah. I've had that thought a couple of times. Like, how are you so like
functional?
Like how? But he describes this whole scene, which is 3 a.m. The door flies open. He thinks that it's one of his kids who's had a nightmare. And, you know, as he would, why would he not think that? You know, I mean, he's got.
Because it's probably happened before. Like, your kids like run downstairs. Shit's like, of course, he'd like you push the door open in a hurry. Right.
Right. And so it's not, it startles him, but he's not like, it's not unusual necessarily.
I don't think it's someone who's come in to kill your entire family, for example.
Which is exactly what happens. You know, they're armed with a 22 and also a sword, by the way.
Super classy weapon, the sword.
Yeah, it's great. You're a total samurai. So here's the fucking Charles and Charles have a handgun and they have this sword and they just open fire on Terry and Penny. Terry was shot 5 times. He survived. 5 gunshots. Each gunshot has like missed a major artery or some kind of, you know, thing that should have killed him by like a millimeter.
It's astonishing.
It's astonishing. He's shot 5 times. Penny was shot multiple times as well, but she didn't really die right away. And at one point, when Terry kind of realized what was happening, like he tried to protect her and he couldn't, obviously. And then he was kind of on the side of the bed and he remembers the footsteps of one of the guys coming over and they kicked him in the foot, I think to make sure he was not going to move again. And so at this point, he hears the cabin that they lived in was 2-story. And so he hears footsteps and they're going up the stairs to where the kids' rooms are.
Oh God. Oh God. Can you imagine? This is just like, I think if you were, I mean, obviously the trauma of this, I can't even begin to imagine, no, but for me, this would be the part that would replay in my mind. The footsteps going up the stairs while I'm lying there incapacitated.
Right.
And knowing that
there's nothing I can do about it.
Right. My children are upstairs and unfucking protected. And like that's my job and I can't mm-hmm. do it. Oh my God. Like that just breaks me just to think about that.
And so when he hears the footsteps going up the stairs, that's exactly what he thinks. He's like, fuck, I need to be able to protect my kids. And he knows that he can't. And all of a sudden he hears Matthew crying out, Charlie, why are you doing this? No, Charlie, no. That was the last thing that he heard. With that, I'm going to leave that alone.
We're not going to go into it here.
No, no. And so at this point, you know, Terry's, he's trying to get up. He's shot multiple times. His wife is dead, he thinks, at this point. He's just like, I can't save her. Well, he had passed out once and then he woke up and then passed out a second time. And when he woke up, the room was on fire. At this point, the whole house is on fire and he realizes that he cannot get to his children at all. And so he's got to figure out a way to get out of this house. And he does look at Penny one last time to make sure. And he sees that not only was she shot, but after she was shot at some point while he was passed out, one of the boys had come back and used the sword and nearly decapitated her.
Can you imagine you're lying there with 5 gunshot wounds in you and looking at your wife who you've built this life with, these children with, and you know your children are probably dead upstairs and she's, like you said, almost decapitated. That's horrific. I mean, at this point, something amazing is able to galvanize Terry and he just drags himself through a bathroom window and he's able to make his way just out of the blazing husk of his house where he knows his whole family is dead. And make his way to his neighbors. They live about 400 yards away. That's not an inconsiderable distance when you've got 5 bullet holes in you. It took him about an hour to drag himself those 400 yards. He recollected, and this is part of, you know, his memoirs of this event. He recollected at about the halfway point that he wanted to die. I think we could all probably appreciate how he got to that point.
I can completely understand that.
Yeah. I can imagine that that was a dark time in terms of his faith as well. I think for, you know, a person as righteous and godly as he was and very pious and very, very attuned to the ways of the church, suicide is kind of like not really a go-to.
No.
That must have been a really big, a horrific moment of kind of loss of faith.
Absolute despair.
Yeah, I can't even begin. But he thought to himself, if I couldn't save my family, I've got to live long enough to make the people who did this accountable. So he got to his neighbor's house, dragged his ass there, bleeding horribly, and his neighbors open the door, they pull him inside, they call 911, and you know, everybody turns up, he's taken to the hospital.
And before he was taken to the hospital, they did not think he was going to survive. I mean, why would you ever think that? The man, at this point, the man had been shot in the face. Theoretically, like none of these bullets should have been survivable because everything was at close range. So because they weren't sure if he was going to survive, he was still alive. They jumped in the ambulance. The investigator jumps in the ambulance. It's Richard Allman. And he's like asking Terry all these rapid fire questions. He's just like, you know, who did this? What happened?
Yeah. Get it while you can get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because they don't know if he's going to make it. Terry then says, they're all gone. Charlie Wilkinson shot my family. Honestly, that's the most badass thing out of this whole thing because these fuckers thought they were going to get away with everything And he willed himself to live so that he could tell them who did it.
He's such an impressive person to me. I know there's like ifs, buts, and maybes about everything that he did, but it's like in terms of just strength of character.
Seriously. I mean, you talk about a will.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Just pure iron will.
And so the ambulance takes him away. They initially took him to the first hospital. It wasn't a trauma unit. And they were like, what the fuck are you doing bringing him here? He's got to, I think they sent him to Dallas, Fort Worth. Mm-hmm. And so he's got to go there. And so they stabilized him. And then he had to make another trip to the hospital where there was a trauma unit. And so, you know, and it was real touch and go, you know, with all of his injuries. And so they, at least at this point, the investigators had a place to start. They knew a name. They knew this boy. Because one of the sheriffs in town, his sons knew Charlie Wilkinson. And so it's a town of like, I think it's like 1,200 people. It's very small.
Yeah, everybody knows everybody knows everybody.
And so on the way over to the call, the sheriff had noticed Charlie Wilkinson's car parked in front of Charlie Wade's brother's house. So he's like, oh, I know where he is. And it was kind of like, in that moment, like really kind of poetic because, I mean, as we're going to get to in a quick second, these punk asses were all caught within 24 hours. So, I mean, it was pretty great. Something that is really unfortunate, I think, in addition to the horrible, horrible murders that happened, was the reasoning behind it for the $2,000. There was a lockbox in the house that had some cash in it. Before they set the house on fire, they had returned to get the lockbox, open it up, take out the money. And they also ransacked the house for jewelry. They stole money out of Penny's purse and they took any money that was in Terry's wallet. That amounted to about $375. So their haul was like $2,300, $2,400 and some jewelry. Really? That's what you're going to set your life up on? And so I think the most disturbing thing is what I read about the autopsies, which is that all three of the victims were found with smoke inhalation, meaning,
Oh, fuck.
They were not dead. They were still breathing when the house was on fire.
I mean, that's firstly fucking an incompetent fucking job,
right?
At a time when the most merciful thing that you can do is be fucking competent at this. I mean, that's a horrible thing to say, but like, if you're going to kill somebody,
please don't leave them there to burn to death in addition to these injuries.
I hope they must have known that. I mean, no, they must know that now that they're in prison.
They must.
And I hope that that just lingers and lingers. And I hope they smell smoke every night and just imagine that.
That was a really hard thing to read because I wasn't expecting to read that. You know, after you read what happens, you kind of expect that that's going to be the end.
You're like, well, at least it was quick.
Right. Exactly. You hope. And then you read that and you're like, oh, my God. It wasn't in their autopsy. Yeah.
That's very distressing.
So meanwhile, these four idiots are driving around in this Dodge Neon that belongs to Bobby, who is now a total accessory to all of this because she waited in the car with Aaron, who was just sitting there while her parents were being slaughtered and while her two brothers were being murdered as well. I mean, what in the world would you talk about while you're waiting in the car with Bobby? And so prior to the murders, they had driven around for about an hour to create the plan. It was definitely a premeditated thing. They did go into it with a very loose, stupid plan. But apparently, Charlie had really tried to convince her not to go through with this. Now, I don't think that that makes him any better as a person.
No.
But all three accomplices say the same thing, that Aaron is the one who pushed for the murders. And that everybody was kind of like, Charlie was kind of like, nah, she wanted it to happen.
She did want it to happen. And you know what? She did really well in gathering around her a very spineless bunch of gutless, easily led cowards.
Yeah.
Like, if you're going to be a narcissistic, like, sociopath with, like, murderous ideation, who better to surround yourself with than, like, hapless, brainless?
Yeah, than people who are going to do your bidding.
Exactly, like little minions. Yeah. But you have to find people who don't have strength of character, and that's what she managed to do.
Yeah, she 100% did. After everything was all said and done, and they were driving around for a little while, I guess, to come off of the high of murdering, Aaron and Charlie were dropped off at Wade's brother's trailer, the one that I mentioned a little while ago, that the cop had seen his car in front of. They went back there to have sex to celebrate.
Was that her first sexual sexy?
I don't think that it was her first, but I think it was one of her first.
You know, what better way to celebrate your family slaughter than to have sexy times in Wade's brother's trailer?
His rundown blue single wide trailer.
Wow, that sounds hygienic.
Well, it's going to get worse. As we said before, it's a really small town. These guys are really stupid. And so those two things really worked in the authorities' favor. I mean, what better scenario do you want? You have the guy who got shot telling you who did it. You have an extremely small pool of possible people to choose from. Mm-hmm. And you saw the guy's car who was named in this. Like, it's kind of great. Like, they're,
it's all just coming together.
It all really, I mean, if there has to be any kind of like silver lining in this, at least it didn't drag out. It didn't turn into a cold case or anything, you know, terrible that way.
And Erin is the rug that ties the room together.
She's definitely the rug that ties the room together. So yeah, yay for stupid criminals.
Woo-hoo!
Woo! After they were done with all the murdering and the stupid, horrible things that they did, they took the sword and they dumped it in a river along with Erin's suitcase that she had pre-packed.
That's dumb. Like, what's incriminating in there? You're like,
totally nothing. I mean, where? Why is Erin Caffey's clothing here with the sword?
Whoa, wow. It doesn't make any sense. I'm sure they're unconnected.
I'm pretty sure I've seen Erin in every one of these outfits recently.
Mysterious.
There's an assistant attorney general by the name of Lisa Tanner, and she had said that Charles actually bought a second pair of boots the morning after the killings, and Bobby went to work at the DQ. Just like a normal day.
I wonder what could have possibly been on his boots that required him to buy a second pair. What could have not washed off easily? I can't imagine.
Oh, you mean like blood evidence?
Oh no. I don't know why you would say that.
Certainly not blood evidence.
Mm-hmm.
No, I would never insinuate such a thing.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. All alleged, right? So Bobby was arrested at the Dairy Queen, as you do. Bobby, great job. And then Charles was arrested as he was driving around. Lisa Tanner said that Charles' thinking about the boots was that if he got away with this, that he'd have two pairs of boots.
Wait.
Yep, you heard it right.
Wait, it's like 1 + 2 equals buttons. That doesn't make any sense.
Exactly.
Wait, if they got away with it, he'd have two pairs of boots. Is that like that's a plus, right? Like, whoa-hoo!
I mean, I don't know.
It's really worth it for the boots alone? Like,
I feel like, no, doesn't add up for me.
Not one of the great minds of our time, this one.
No, definitely not. So after Terry named Charlie, Sheriff Fisher, who was the other investigator on scene, goes back to this trailer, right? Matthew Wade's trailer. This is Charles Wade's brother. It really sounds like such an oasis, a place of relaxation, a zen garden, if you will.
Order, tranquility.
It's what anybody would want if they were on bath salts. So when he goes in there, he's got to step over piles after piles after piles of nasty ass dirty laundry, empty beer cans, because, you know, as you do, just throw your empty beer cans on the floor. I'm quite sure it had to be Natty Light. I feel it in my bones. It had to be Natty Light. That's totally me throwing shade at Natty Light, by the way.
Sponsor us.
But yeah. And so as the sheriff continues down the hall and, you know, he's kind of making his way through this obstacle course of filthy laundry and empty beer cans.
Oh God.
He sees a door frame, but it doesn't have a door.
That's never a good sign.
It does have a blanket because no door, no problem. And so he kind of like pulls the blanket back, right? And he sees Charlie Wilkinson lying on a mattress. I don't think there was any kind of frame or box spring. I'm pretty sure this mattress was just on the floor. And he's laying there awake with no shirt on. And he's got a handgun right next to him. And so Sheriff Fisher says, "Charlie, it's Kurt. Let me see your hands." Charlie says, "What's going on?" And so Fisher says, "Let me see your hands." And he just knew. And so he read Charlie Wilkinson his rights. And he asked him, he said, "Were you involved in this?" And Charlie's initial response was, "No, sir. I got drunk last night and passed out."
These things are so easily disprovable, dumbass.
Right. But it goes to show the, you know, the limbic system, right?
Yeah. Maybe there was something in the water and just like.
It might have been. Yeah. So at this point, you know, they take him in and the sheriff obtains a search warrant, right? And they go and they're like, we're going to collect some evidence. And they don't know that Erin is involved in any way. They haven't found her. They don't know where she is.
They probably assume that she's somewhere. She's a skeleton somewhere in the house.
Yeah, they think she's in the house because Terry doesn't know that she wasn't there. Mm-hmm. So he's thinking all three of his children are dead. He's thinking, obviously, his wife is gone. He's not in any way, shape, or form. It's not even on his radar at all that Erin could possibly be involved in this.
Just when he thinks his day can't get any fucking worse.
Right. And so when Sheriff Fisher goes back to this trailer, in the living room, he finds a really classy choice. It was a camouflage colored purse. Colored purse. I don't even think it was like fabric. It just sounded like it was actually a colored, like, I don't know. Maybe it was patent leather. I don't know. And it has a driver's license in it. And the license belongs to Erin Caffey. And so he's just like, you know, he's starting to put it together. And now he's thinking like, oh my God, like maybe we have an abduction on our hands.
Right.
And so he starts searching around. And he goes to the back bedroom where Charlie had been found. And he's kind of, you know, these are not big rooms, by the way.
Mm-hmm. It's a trailer, right? It's not a vast structure.
You have to kind of like, you know, yeah, set your expectations with a single wide trailer. Those rooms are not big.
Yeah, there's not like an east wing. Yeah.
Yeah. And so anyway, like just like how that doorway didn't have a door, the windows don't have curtains. They have blankets. And so he's just like, he pushes the blanket aside and he sees empty shell casings on the floor. I don't know if they had been shooting a gun in the trailer. It seems like a bad idea.
It also doesn't seem beyond the realm of possibility for this crew.
No, I mean, I could get on board with it. I mean, I could see it happening. I'm not saying no, it didn't happen. There's a box of ammunition and the classiest touch of all, a used condom just on the floor.
It's like the...
throw that shit away.
It's like a silk ribbon that just ties the entire thing in one beautiful package.
Isn't it though?
One drippy, just drenched, used, flaccid package.
Yeah, just a beautiful DNA party happening right there on the floor.
Nice. Well, at least they practiced safe sex.
She said she wasn't ready for a baby. He's respecting her choices as a woman. Way to go. Next to this used condom, I have to laugh because it's just so fitting. Near this closet in this room, there was like a blanket and it had laundry on top. It seems like the laundry in this house was a real problem. And stuffed animals, as you would have on top of this. And he kind of sees something and it looks like blonde hair.
Like a doll or something.
Yeah, that's what they thought at first. They're like, well, that's weird. There's a blonde doll or a wig or something. And he pulls it back and there's fucking Erin Caffey with her back to the wall, her little 4'11" body back to the wall, all in the fetal position, like laying next to this used condom.
Wow. You know, if you're an investigator, you're putting two and two together and you're coming up with kidnapping and like probable rape. And, you know, she probably she looks all traumatized, you know, like
she's not with it. So they think automatically when they're talking to her, like she's just kind of like, you know, with acting very
drugged.
It was almost as though like they thought that she could have potentially been given like GHB or like any kind of like drug that would knock you out.
Like Rohypnol. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And so that's how they were kind of approaching this at first. So Sheriff Fisher says, you're Erin Caffey. Can you tell me what happened? And all she said to him was fire. And so he said, how did you get here? And she goes, I don't know where I am.
Wow.
So she's now for like the third time completely turned, right? The first time being when she said to her parents that she wanted to break up with Charlie. Mm-hmm. The second time when she was having a pillow fight with her family right before she had them fucking slaughtered. And then now a third time gonna turn on the people who did it by saying she doesn't know where she's at. She is so incredibly calculating. At 16, thank God she's locked up.
I know, seriously, right? She's a fucking danger. This is the thing that happens with like extreme narcissists, is they can do this thing where they can sort of slip into roles that they understand that people want.
Yeah.
So when she's around certain kinds of people, she'll act in certain kinds of ways. Like she can just weep tears of joy at this like angelic feeling that she's feeling, like, because that's what people expect and want. And she knows that they love it. Like she can become, I mean, I don't think she's very skilled at it, but that she's trying to clearly make the attempt.
Yeah, but she was only 16. Imagine if she had practiced what she could have become if she hadn't gotten herself caught, like how dangerous she could have become.
Absolutely. People like that who just act without anything guiding them or stopping them. It's just like, whatever you want, you do.
And who have no remorse. And so at this point, right, they take her because they're like, oh, thank God, you know, there's another survivor of this family. We've got the dad, Terry. Now we've got his daughter, Erin. And so because they're treating her as though she's a victim, they take her and they run all these tests on her. And she's acting as though she's very confused. And she keeps telling the investigators, I'm only 14. She's 16. Keeps telling them that she's younger than she is. And then the story that she spins is that it was two guys with swords dressed in black who broke into the house and were forcing her onto the floor. Didn't know how she'd gotten to the trailer, but kept calling her friend Charlie for help. Now, something that was really a huge like nail in her coffin was the phone records that really show how many times she had gotten in touch with Charlie right before the murders. And so she said that she had been trying to call him, blah, blah. So I don't know if she was thinking like phone records or what, but she did add that in. And then she's also said that she, quote unquote, drank some stuff at the trailer, but then couldn't remember anything after.
Oh, I can't imagine what stuff you could be implying that you might have drunk, Erin.
Yeah. And so apparently in the beginning of this interview, it could be taken one way or the other. If you're still thinking she's a victim, you could think, oh, she's just in shock. Like she hasn't processed this yet.
Fair enough. Yeah.
You know, that is kind of fair enough, right?
Right. It's a traumatic experience, a very confusing smoke, fire, la, la, la.
Yeah. You're just sitting there and you're like you're just sort of like recounting this thing that has just happened to you. You haven't processed it. Like, of course you're not, you know, but then you might be a puddle of emotion. Like mm-hmm. I would be, you know, I mean, we all process things differently. She was asked by one of the people who was questioning her, you know, if she had anything else to say. And she said, they're coming after me. Really?
That's pretty stupid because like, how do you know that? Now you've got a whole nother story you have to weave to explain that statement.
Yeah. Jennifer Pan.
Yeah. thank you.
Casey Anthony, you dumbass. They also, at this point, were kind of noticing some weird things like she didn't smell like smoke.
Yeah, if you wake up in a house full of smoke, you're going to smell like smoke.
You're going to smell like a campfire.
That's right.
Yeah.
And or a burning house or burning bodies of your family.
Yeah. One of the most heartbreaking things about this is that Penny's mom, Virginia, came while Erin was being questioned and given her evaluations. And she came to tell her that Terry had survived, as though this was going to make Erin's day and at least she'd be thankful for one surviving family member. And I really felt like, man, you just lost your daughter. You just lost your grandchildren, mm-hmm. two of them. And you're telling your remaining granddaughter who you think has escaped something terrible that she has one surviving family member. I mean, I cannot imagine what she was thinking when she found out that Erin was the one who was behind this.
I can't imagine the shock. I think that there would just be a period of time where your brain just like, all right, I understand the information that you just told me, but I'm going to need like several minutes just to let that filter into my like conscious mind of what that really means.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just unfathomable to me, mm-hmm. you know, simultaneously as this is happening, Charlie, you know, is being questioned at the sheriff's office and he just spills his guts, man. He is just like going to sing, sing, sing. He's telling them everything they want to know. And he gave up really easily. He was just like, I'm in a lot of trouble. And they asked him, you know, what happened. And he pretty much said, you know, that Erin was still pretty pissed off about her parents saying that they couldn't see each other anymore.
Apparently.
Yeah. And that she wanted them dead. He said, I told her to just run away. And that Erin's response to that was no, kill them. That is some ice cold shit right there.
It is really, really chilly, isn't it? It's just like he's the guy that you want to be with is literally giving you an out. He's just like, look, we can just run away. We don't have to do this at all.
Right.
Like he's giving you a way to have what you want, which is to live a life away from your family's influence.
And again, I go back to what I said earlier. It would have lasted a month. There's no way.
No.
The most sheltered girl in the world. Like she's either. Yeah. Anyway. Initially, he would not give up Charles Wade, his friend. He was like not about to be a snitch on his friend. But then, you know, ultimately in like 5 minutes, he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Charles Wade's motivation was nothing except for the $2,000 to help kill the Caffeys. That was it. He literally did this for money. He was a murder for hire is what this was.
He had to have that quality of being merciless.
I would think so.
Or cold hearted enough that he could just easily do this. I mean, there's something about him. He's either just not really put together the right way. I mean, he was known to not exactly be He wasn't the town intellect. And that I'm not just disparaging people who have developmental disabilities, because that's not what I perceive to be here.
No,
he just didn't use the brain that God gave him.
Correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, he was an idiot.
He was just a dumbass. He made dumbass choices and didn't really have much of a conscience, and put that to, I was going to say good use, but actually was quite the opposite.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, they pick up Bobby, like I said, they pick up Charles Wade, like I said, and they all have an identical story in that Erin was the one to mastermind everything. She was the driving force. They all agreed separately. I mean, you know, they weren't talking to each other before they got arrested. They didn't have any time.
No.
And so they had no time to get a story straight. And Erin was with them when they were driving around after the murders. And so they couldn't have discussed it then. I mean,
because it was right in front of her.
Maybe on the way over to her house before they picked her up. But I can't imagine that they had that kind of foresight. And so
I can't imagine that they had that kind of foresight is the absolute summary of this case.
And so really what we're talking about is that three out of four of these people have a very consistent story. And she is the common denominator who is the driving force behind this. And that's really what it boils down to. And in terms of why they killed the boys, it's because they didn't want any witnesses to be left behind. But I have a really hard time with that, because the witnesses wouldn't have been able to be a witness. Those boys' bedrooms were upstairs.
Yeah, they could have just run in.
Their parents' bedroom was downstairs. They could have gone in, committed the murders.
Been masked if they wanted to. That would have not been hard.
But Erin wanted them dead as well, because they didn't want witnesses,
they're spiteful.
Yeah. I'm like, I just can't wrap my head around that one at all. She had left the front door open for them. Like, everything was agreed upon. Everything was set in motion. And it was all Erin's doing.
I read somewhere, I can't remember where, I have to track it down, that part of her motivation for making sure that her brothers were killed was that sometimes they teased her, or it was like two against one. It was like the boys against her.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know what? Welcome to being a sibling. Siblings are assholes to each other. That's just what siblings do.
And not only that, you're the oldest sibling.
Right. Grow the fuck up.
Up against a 13-year-old and an 8-year-old? Like, well, you can't hold your own against an 8-year-old, Erin?
Right. Seriously. He's a little boy. Like, little kids are sometimes assholes. Get over it.
And know that they're little kids. And maybe don't engage. I don't know. Whatever. Forethought.
She's not worth it. She's not worth our time.
No, she's not.
Except here we are.
As Charles Wade was being questioned, he really didn't show any kind of remorse whatsoever. I will say for Charlie Wilkinson that he did show some remorse. In the footage of the interrogation with Charles Wade, you can kind of see there's some forehead rubbing happening, you know, and that like stress, like I'm caught. Mm-hmm. But I think from what I could tell with the Charlie Wilkinson thing, I think that he did have some remorse. I think that he knew that it wasn't the right choice. He obviously knew it wasn't the right choice if he was trying to convince her to do something like run away instead. Mm-hmm. You know, he had to know that there was a better option out there. And then, you know, initially Bobby was kind of like, I don't know. And then they presented her with like what was going on. And she was like, oh, yeah. So it was Erin behind all of this. And so everybody kind of turned on Erin. And so when they kind of were starting to put two and two together, they were initially taking Erin to see Terry, and she was with the investigators who had given her the test and to see if she had any drugs in her system, to see, you know, to check her out physically.
Or like for Hypnol and stuff like that.
Yeah. And all of that came back negative. She didn't have anything in her system. She didn't have any drugs in her system. There was no trace of alcohol in her. She was sober. Apparently the boys had like a few beers, probably tossed back a couple of Natty Lights the night before and threw the cans on the floor of the trailer. As you
crushed them on their foreheads.
Oh yeah, easily. But other than that, there was no other drugs involved. Like there was nothing in anybody's system. And so that means that everybody was like
stone cold sober,
completely aware of their actions. Mm-hmm. And so with that, the investigators called the women who had been talking with Erin as she was on her way to go and meet her dad at the hospital. Now, I had said that Virginia, Penny's mom, was there to tell her that Terry was alive. So Erin was riding with Virginia, and Virginia was following these two investigators in her car. And So when the investigators got the call, thankfully Aaron wasn't in the car, but they said, we need you to bring her in. She needs to come in. She's going to be arrested. And they were like, what? And so they even were kind of caught off guard. They pull over. Virginia pulls over. They get out of the car and they tell them what's going on. And at this point, you know, Virginia's just lost her daughter and her two grandsons. And now she's just like, what the fuck? Did you have anything to do with this? And Aaron was, you know, denying all involvement.
Mm-hmm. And Virginia was like screaming in Aaron's face.
Yeah. And so because she was 16, she couldn't be questioned. And so she had to go. You know, she was a juvenile, right? Mm-hmm. And so they decided to hold her and she was held on a $1.5 million bail.
Oh, that's not fucking around.
You're not getting out. Girl, you're not no, getting girl. Out.
Nope, nope. That's a pretty significant freaking bail. So yeah, she stayed in jail and Terry and the rest of the remaining family visited her. Terry later said that when he saw her, she looked dead in the eyes.
And she does look dead in the eyes.
She does, doesn't she? She looked like she's like just lost a whole bunch of something.
Her soul?
Maybe that. Yeah, it turns out that when you like actively encourage somebody to murder your family, there's something that you really can't go back from.
Yeah, you wouldn't think so. I mean, the things that she did and the ramifications that it had, the fact that Terry, after he was discharged from the hospital, was suicidal for a very long time after this, like mm-hmm. her actions, it didn't just end that night. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a ripple effect forever.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, she didn't intend for Terry to survive, but he did. And now he's got to live with this.
No, exactly. And he actually wrote about his sort of survival of this experience.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a quote here I'm going to read. So this quote comes at a period where he's, as we said, contemplating ending his life. So 2 or 3 days I pondered on this. Somebody brought me a Bible and told me to read the book of Job. Well, I'd read the story countless times before, but I read it again, and it was almost like I was there with Job. He lost everything, his whole family, all his worldly possessions, but he did not lose his faith, and God blessed him doubly. That turned me around and got me thinking that God might have a plan for me. He didn't bring me through all that for nothing. Man, you know what? I do have to admire the strength of the faith that, like, even at this time where literally, like, anybody would not blame you for being like, ah, I curse you, God. I take back all of my efforts towards you. Like, I personally do not have a spectacular relationship with God. I've had a couple of things occur in my life that kind of made me think, well, you know, maybe if this was planned, then I don't really agree with the planning that went into it. So fuck yeah, you.
Definitely.
Also, you know, I research enough horrific things that show me that humans are more than capable of making hell right here on earth. So I have to admire his faith, but he actually went back to the burned out shell of his house.
Yes, he did.
As soon as he was able to. And he was out of hospital within like about 4 days, I think.
Yeah, it was quick.
Yeah. I mean, that man is unkillable. Like freaking yes. Bruce Willis, man. but he was like picking through the ashes of his burned house. He found like a Hot Wheels car, like a broken cup.
A belt buckle that the kids gave him.
Yeah, this like horseshoe shaped kind of like Western style belt buckle that they gave him for Christmas. And he ended up buying a used RV and put it on the land more or less where the home had been. And he got a lot of shit from people about, they thought he was crazy for going back. Why would you want to go back to a place where such an awful thing had happened? But he actually remarked that he felt quite a bit of peace and felt like he was closer to his family and that it brought him a healing. And you know what? Nobody gets to judge another person's path through their own grief. So fuck you.
yeah.
Right. Exactly. No, but seriously, you don't. And it's like, you know, what is right for one person, you know, one person might have to leave it completely behind and never look at it again. And another person might have to like live amongst the ruins of the place where their family died horribly. And we don't get to judge what's right for one or the other, but
right,
we do get to judge what a piece of shit Aaron is. That's what we do.
Oh yeah. No, for sure. Dude, how about her?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
She's like a pinata. I wish that Aaron was a pinata and I just had like a, I don't know, like a metal baseball bat.
Like a kind of like a Lucille situation from The Walking Dead. There's a place for it. It was a pretty freaking quick trial too. Like it went pretty fast.
Very fast.
There was a lot of evidence and you know, she got put in prison for a really freaking long time.
Yes, she did. You know, it's amazing to me that Terry Caffey has continued to maintain a relationship with Aaron. Mm-hmm. He visits her in prison.
Every week.
In the beginning, it was every week. Mm-hmm. And now I think it's more like once a month.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I think, you know, but still.
Sorry, that was super catty. But like just anything that smacks of a negative experience for Aaron Caffey will
sure
elicit a happy laugh from me.
I know, but you have to wonder if there's any depth to her character that she would even like look at anything like a negative experience. Mm-hmm. But I don't see it. I don't think she has a capability.
It's interesting. Like I think about, does she look back? Is there like a fog? Does she remember that time and be like, you know, I think back on times in my life where I was like really dysregulated or I was really under the influence of, you know, hormones or, you know, a substance, like I was drunk or whatever. And I look back and I'm like, was that really me? Did I really act in that way? And it almost seems like another person.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's how she looks back at her memory of it, or if she's perfectly crystal clear on what she did, or if it makes sense to her, or, you know, if she still feels like she's exactly that person.
Well, she did do an interview with Piers Morgan. I will say for this particular interview, it was the very first episode of Killer Women.
That's right.
And it was a really fascinating interview because to watch Aaron Caffey's body language, I think he really nailed it a couple of times. Like he had her to the wall.
That's true.
She was at, she did one with Dr. Phil as well, and he cornered her pretty good. But, you know, Piers Morgan really kind of broke it down and he said, you know, you only give so much and then it's like a wall comes up because she's one of those people who answer a question like, well, you know, it's like, and it's very choppy that way, you know? And so it's really distracting.
And it's designed to kind of make you forget what the question was in the first place.
That's right.
And to kind of take you in another direction.
Yeah. She's stalling, yeah. Right? You know, and it's distracting to the person who's asked the question. And so it's giving her time to sort of, the more time she can get in between answering the question, like the less meaning her answer has to the person who's asking it, you know, and
red flag.
Right. And so he really nailed it with her when he said that. And it was absolutely true. And just her body language in general, like it's very interesting to watch her body language and her expressions because there were a couple of times and I looked at her and I was like, oh, man, you know, you see her eyes, they are vacant. Yeah. And except for there's one point, which it's in my fun facts, but there's one point where her eyes do kind of light up a little bit, but everything after that is just very like, there's nobody home.
I wonder if it was always like that for her or if looking back, you know, could you identify a time where she was like super animated? Did she always have this like deadness about her? It's interesting.
Yeah.
Did it just come out? Has it now just revealed?
It would be really interesting to find that out. I mean, based on what the people in her church congregation had said about her. I mean, it's like they all sort of viewed her the same way as this like very innocent, naive girl who couldn't find her way out of a fucking paper bag. You know, she was like this just very quote unquote sweet girl.
And having your family murdered is such a, it sounds so weird to say, but such a worldly thing to do. You know, it's such a sort of like, it's so depraved. Mm-hmm. It's the opposite of innocent. You know, it's right. Like you're sheltered, you're innocent, you've been of a very religious household. And then like the opposite end of that is like hit killing.
When Aaron was being questioned, she maintained her original story of being kidnapped and, you know, forced with these guys in black with the sword and everything. She totally maintained that. She tried to make that her story consistently. She never once acknowledged that she was the one behind this, even though everything was in her face. And so, you know, like you said, those trials happened really quickly and the guys were convicted very fast. Both Wilkinson and Wade, they were actually both eligible for the death penalty. And you know, Texas, they're not going to kill you.
Yeah, they're not going to kill you.
I mean, they're like, yeah. As I said, they were both eligible for the death penalty. In 2008, however, they were found guilty and got life in prison without parole because Terry asked that they get life in prison instead of the death penalty.
Now, I'm in two minds about that, but you know.
Yeah, me too.
I was listening to a preamble to a book that described prison. And it described like the smell inside a prison, and that it's the smell that tells you that nothing good happens in here.
Mm-hmm.
He said it's the smell of caged men.
Oh.
And it's this, but it's like specifically this smell that's unhealthy. It's not just like a BO smell of like lots of dudes. It's the smell of like unhealthy, no sunlight, like just bad
scalp
juju.
Oil.
Yeah, scalp oil, foot smell, number one, bad. But it's just a horrible, horrible, depleting, depressing. I mean, people are like, oh, they can turn your eyes around in prison. But like most prisons are real fucking shitty ass places to be.
Oh, for sure.
Horrible. There's violence. There's sexual violence. It's like people don't talk about the boredom. It is profoundly boring to be locked up and to be away from nature and normal human relationships, yeah. To have your life prescribed. You have to wake up early as fuck, go to bed early as fuck. It's noisy all the time. Like prison sucks. So like when people say, oh, it sucks that they didn't die and they got to go to prison for the rest of their life. It's not like living in like a nice little Motel 6 forever.
Oh, for sure. And so, yeah, I'm with you too. I was in two camps because in one way I was kind of like, well, they deserve the death penalty. Look what they mm-hmm. did. But then they're also so incredibly young that they have the rest of their fucking natural lives to sit there and think about what they did. And so at the sentencing, Terry Caffey actually addressed both of them. You know, it was really interesting to me that, again, even in the trial portion of it and the conviction of everything, that Charles Wade still continued to show no remorse.
He can't, though.
There was nothing.
He can't. I mean, this is a guy who slaughtered a family for $2,000.
Right.
Like he can't. There's just like, he doesn't have the wiring for it.
No, he doesn't. But I would have to think anyway, like, God, you'd have to be like, wow, I fucked up. Even if he didn't think about like what he had done was bad, you'd have to kind of think about like, damn, like I really screwed my life up.
Yeah. Even if you don't give a shit about anybody else.
Yeah. Like there's not even like remorse for himself. Like he just sat there like stoic and stone faced as though, you know, it was just, you know, he was watching a Toyota Camry commercial.
Maybe he thought that this part of his life was inevitable. Who knows? Like that he was always going to end up in jail, or it was just like, I don't know. What a strange person. I don't know why you would be so unemotional about essentially like many of the good parts of your life being permanently over.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think about like, you know, his daughter and not even his ex-wife necessarily, but I mean, he did have a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he was like very keen to get custody of her.
Yeah. And so now
for whatever that means, I mean, I don't know.
This is going to be your life now, pal. Like you're never going to, you know, I don't know if they've kept in touch. I don't think so. I mean, they were in the middle of a divorce. I don't know if that baby being 5 months old really needs to know her father.
No, some things you don't need to know. Yeah.
Honestly. But, you know, I mean, when Terry addressed the two guys in the courtroom, he said, in time, God has shown me what it means to forgive Charlie Wilkinson. I want to say to you today that I forgive you, not so much for your sake, but for my own. I refuse to grow into a bitter old man. If I want to heal and move on, I must find some forgiveness in my heart. And that has been the hardest thing I've ever had to do because you took so much from me. I just can't even wrap my head around it. But, you know, he and Charles Wade are both going to serve out a life with no parole sentence. Charles Wade is in a facility called Beto in Texas. And Charles Wilkinson is in a maximum security prison that's best known for death row. So that sucks, dude. The only person who seems to have accepted any kind of responsibility for their own actions is Bobby Johnson.
Who's like honestly, the person who's least responsible in all of this. She's just stupid. She just played along. I mean, she could have stopped it if she really wanted to, right? She could have like stopped it and called the cops and said, my friends are about to kill a family.
She could have. And that's why she got 40 years in prison. She is, however, eligible for parole in 2028 after serving 20 years. For the woman of the hour, Erin, she's now 30 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, in my mind, I think of her as, you know, like a child.
Right.
But like that was a while ago.
Yeah, this is 2008. She was eligible for life in prison, but Terry had requested that she get a lesser sentence because he wanted her to have something to live for. He was still thinking about her life and having a purpose for her and having a reason to get up every single day. And so she took a plea deal. She got two life sentences to serve concurrently plus 25 years. I think grand total, she'll be eligible for parole when she's 59. with everything added up together. And Terry, I do believe that if for some reason, like, you know, unless he dies of some horrible disease or, you know, something happens out of the blue, his hope is to be there the day she gets released. And he says, quote, "My prayer is that I will live long enough. I want to go and I want to get Aaron. I want us to walk away arm in arm and never look back." Yeah, that's Aaron Caffey, everybody.
Aaron Caffey, what a piece of work. And Keita, do you have any fun facts for us this evening as we leave Aaron Caffey behind?
Yes, I do, actually. Several. Mm-hmm. Penny Caffey, we didn't talk a lot about, except for her horrible, horrible murder. She was actually in a Christian band called the Gaston Singers. And apparently she played piano, right? And she was apparently really talented. But they played for various churches and they recorded albums. They actually had like legitimate albums recorded. Hmm. And their last hit was in 2007 and it was titled If We Never Meet Again, which I thought was kind of gives me the chills when I read that.
I'm a little like, creepy.
Yeah. Let's see. Just a couple of weeks after the killings, Charlie's defense attorney informed him that he wasn't the first man Aaron had asked to kill her parents.
What?
Remember the boy who she was caught making out with?
Oh, yeah.
Apparently she'd mentioned something about that.
Just kind of dropped it as a little light suggestion.
Well, yeah, like, wouldn't it be great to like kill my parents? What? No, nothing. I'm just, I meant.
Just kidding, but not really.
Yeah, she'd asked somebody else before she asked Charlie. And so his response to that, and I gotta love the self-awareness here. Quote, "It made me question a lot of things. After months of pushing me and convincing me and all this, I got to thinking that maybe all I was just a tool." Yeah, you are a tool.
That is just like a setup and a slam dunk joke.
Yeah,
like,
I know. The jokes write themselves.
They really do.
And then he also goes on to say, "I don't know what's wrong with her head. She needs to have it looked at." Yeah, bro.
Yeah.
That's probably the smartest thing you've ever said. And they are banned from ever speaking again. They haven't spoken since the morning of the murders.
That's probably for the best. Forgiveness is a core tenet of most religions, and it is a redeeming virtue in Christianity. Terry Caffey is a good Christian and embodies this virtue with every breath he takes. His faith seems to be unshakable. If the literal living hell his daughter put him through couldn't shake his commitment to God, what possibly could? I envy that kind of faith. I was surprised by the depth and strength of Terry Caffey's piety, and humans generally do not surprise me. In the cases we cover, I can usually wrap my head around the thought process of the killer from a clinical perspective. But in this case, I just couldn't wrap my head around Aaron Caffey's thought process. I understood that she wanted to be with her boyfriend, that she was angry at her parents, but the jump from there to planning a murder of her entire family, even her younger brothers, seems like a breathtakingly stupid one. From an adult perspective, this makes no sense, but the teenage brain is a different beast. This doesn't excuse the actions of the killers we profiled in this episode, but it helps to explain how they were able to take the kind of actions they did, actions that appall and baffle the rest of us. The teenage brain is influenced by a different set of chemicals to the adult brain. Their reward system is stimulated by the pleasure of risk, the thrill of impulsivity, the surging tides of serotonin and dopamine, neurotransmitters whose hedonistic rewards drown out the warnings of common sense and long-term consequences. The planner of this crime, Aaron Caffey, 16 years old, is a perfect example of the triumph of the amygdala over the prefrontal cortex, and also an example of how some bad wiring can cause the apple to fall very, very far from the tree. You've been listening to Homicide Worldwide.
Thank you.
It's all the lumps on my back.
Exactly.
Like it's that. My hunchback, yeah.
I'm working on mine, dude. It's getting there. I'm going to be able to store things on it soon.
Mm-hmm. I have a horrible habit of having really bad posture. Mm-hmm. And somebody out there who is listening once told me that you're going to get a shelf.
I can't imagine who that was.
Yeah, you can't imagine who that was. No,
I can't.
You know who she is.
I do know who she is.
And she knows who she is.
That's right. We love you anyway.
Yeah.